Hello, this is Anil Kumar from Back to the Bible radio broadcast. Today, we are going to look at what Jesus did on Tuesday of the Passion Week in our series, Journey to the Cross. Dr. John Neufeld will take us back to the great controversy that Jesus had with the leaders of Israel in this message entitled, The Journey Demands a Commitment to Truth.
Some of you may remember the first Star Wars trilogy. I know, it was silly and unscientific, and it had rotten theology. And furthermore, Princess Leia had very bad hair. But if you can get by all that, it was very popular. It was a trilogy of movies. The first was entitled Star Wars, and it featured rebel freedom fighters who blew up the evil Empire's Death Star. And the second movie was called The Empire Strikes Back. That's because evil men do not sit idly by when their power is being threatened. The Tuesday of Passion Week could also be called The Empire Strikes Back. By Tuesday, the chief priests, teachers of the law, and the elders of Israel had decided this cannot go on. Jesus' presence at the Passover was so overwhelming, so strong, and so destabilizing to their control, they decided they must stop him immediately. But one could not simply arrest him. That might lead to a riot they so feared. And so they decided they will publicly discredit him. They will make him look foolish in front of the people. And after that, they will drive a wedge between him and the people. And then they can safely arrest him and kill him. And this attempt to manipulate Jesus and discredit him will take place on Tuesday. This will be a day of breathtaking spectacle. For Jesus, the day begins as was now the custom during this week. He has spent the night at Bethany, and in the morning he takes his disciples on that 3-kilometer journey back to Jerusalem. On the way, no doubt he is on the Mount of Olives, they come upon the fig tree that he had cursed on the previous morning. By now it's withered to the roots. Peter is the one who notices it first and says, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered." I imagine they all stop here, and on the spot, Jesus has something to say that, unfortunately, many people have misunderstood. Jesus said, "Have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him." That statement has led some to argue that Christians can claim anything they want. If they claim it in faith, it will be done. Even mountains can be thrown into the ocean. Now look, there are plenty of passages in the Bible on prayer where we are told to ask God whatever we wish and it will be done. 1 John 5:14 and 15 says, "And this is the confidence that we have toward him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know that we have the requests that we have asked of him." I notice we are promised when we ask within the revealed will of God that we as believers are given what I would call stunning promises. God stands ready to intervene on our behalf if we will but come to him in faith. But that's not what I mean when I say that Jesus has been misunderstood in what he said while the disciples were observing the withered fig tree. I mean, Jesus has been misunderstood wherever there is a teaching that goes something like this: "Speak to the mountains in your life and they'll be removed." You know, behind this teaching is the very bad idea of reinterpreting what is meant by the word faith. In the Bible, faith is confident trust in God, that God will both act for his glory and for our long-term good. Now, with this attitude, we go to him with humble prayer requests, yet bold assurance. But for some, the so-called faith teachers, faith is not trust in God. Instead, for them, the definition of faith looks more like the force in the Star Wars series. Faith for them is a force that pervades the universe, and when you get a hold of this power source, we can command mountains and they will obey us. So we don't speak to God, we simply speak to the mountain, and faith and not God moves the mountain. So please notice what Jesus actually said on that Tuesday morning. Did you notice he didn't tell his disciples, "If you have faith, you can go around commanding any old mountain to do something and it will be thrown into the sea." He didn't say any mountain. He was amazingly particular. He said, "This mountain." clearly has a very specific mountain in view. I might even argue he was probably at that moment even pointing at the mountain he was referring to. So which mountain does he have in mind? Now, if you listened to me yesterday, you'll remember that I said the cursing of the fig tree was symbolic of Jesus cursing the temple. That fig tree stood on the Mount of Olives, where Jesus and his disciples were in full view of the temple. Furthermore, as they come back to the fig tree on Tuesday morning, they're again looking from the Mount of Olives down the steep descent into the Kidron Valley, then up the steep ascent into Jerusalem, with the temple occupying the highest ground in Jerusalem, ground that was often called the Temple Mount. So, when Jesus said, if anyone says to this mountain, he's referring to the Temple Mount. If anyone says to this Temple Mount, be removed and cast into the sea. I hope you understand what Jesus is saying here. He is saying, and I am the anyone who is saying it, and does not doubt in his heart, for Jesus does not doubt for a moment that what he says comes directly from the predetermined plan of the Father. That's why he does not doubt, and with his clear view of what the Father has already planned. I am now announcing this temple will be removed and thrown into the sea. And as we noticed yesterday, it was less than 40 years later that the Roman army would surround that temple and burn it to the ground, and for 2,000 years, no temple has been permitted to stand there. Jesus prophesied it, and it came to be. Now, I'm not sure the disciples got any of that. Now, that very evening, as Jesus was leading his disciples back out of the city, they would say to him, look, Lord, how lovely and how beautiful is this temple? And Jesus would have to repeat himself. Do you see all this? There will not be left one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. But these statements seem impossible to them. It seems so unlikely. Doesn't the temple have a major role and a place to play in the kingdom to come? And of course, the answer to that would have been yes. But at this moment, Jesus knows why he has come to this Passover. His coming marks the turning point of Israel's history, the turning point of the temple sacrifices, the turning point in understanding of how one can approach God. Jesus was coming to Jerusalem to be the Passover Lamb, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, something that an endless river of sacrifices of sheep and goats could never accomplish. But the disciples don't understand. And so Jesus and the 12 leave the living parable of the withered fig tree standing on the Mount of Olives and make their way back into Jerusalem, where the enemies of Jesus have been preparing to discredit him. From their vantage point, it is not the temple that is at risk. It is Jesus himself who is at risk. The temple they think will never be torn down, but they will tear down this upstart prophet from Galilee who makes himself out as if he were the Messiah. But Jesus knows what's waiting for him. No sooner has he entered the temple than the chief priests and the elders of Israel are standing there waiting and ready. They confront him. On Sunday, you almost caused a riot in this city by coming in on a donkey, attempting to fulfill the prophecy found in Zechariah 9:9. And on Monday, you threw the money changers out of the temple, and who knows why you've come here today? We're the elders of Israel, and we, as elders, have been given the authority to direct the Passover celebration. And you are wrecking what is under our authority. Who gave you the authority to do what you've been doing? Ah, it looks like they have him. He's just a troublemaker, and they will expose that soon enough. What makes all of this so evil is that a little more than a year into his ministry, the elders of Israel argued that Christ's authority came from Beelzebub, the prince of demons. They said he has authority to do miracles because that authority came from Satan. Now, they don't repeat the charge here. That would be too inflammatory. I suspect that they had a secret strategy meeting the night before and had agreed to try to tone the language down. Instead of making a charge against him, let's make him look silly. When he says he has God's authority, let's ask him if this is the same God who established the temple and the leadership in the temple. They think they have him in their sights, and they are prepared. But Jesus was ready for them, and without hesitation, he answers, I'll ask you a question, and if you answer it, then I'll tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. A moment's pause. What to say now? But before they can answer, Jesus carries on. Here's my question to you. John the Baptist, when he baptized, was his authority from heaven or from men? Wow, that got everyone's attention. This was an amazing sore spot. Many of the people watching this interchange had gone to hear John preach, and many had been baptized by John, and they still basked in the glow of that ministry. He changed their lives, and none of these elders of Israel had changed their lives. And that's what the elders of Israel hated most about John. The crowd in the temple grew deathly quiet, and then almost comically, the elders of Israel caucused. If we say John's authority came from heaven, he will ask us why we resisted his authority and refused his ministry. But if we say it came from men, this crowd will turn against us in a second. Given the passions that Jesus has already excited this Passover, they might even stone us. Strange, isn't it? How quickly matters changed. The elders of Israel thought they had Jesus. In less than a minute, he had them. And so they respond, "We don't know by what authority he did this." And Jesus is all over that one. "Then neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing this." And when we come back, we're going to see what that leads to.
As we unpack this pivotal moment in Jesus last week, we begin to understand why it was so important that he confronted the elders with such boldness and intent in the days leading up to the cross. We see also Jesus' emphasis on the fact that he was coming to replace the very temple itself through what he accomplished on the cross, though even his own disciples did not understand this yet. Back to the Bible, leading people into a dynamic relationship with God. The Bible contains many passages about the topic of wisdom. Here are a few examples. James chapter 1 verse 5 says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him." Or how about Ecclesiastes chapter 7 verse 12 says, "For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. And the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it." Wisdom is a critically important issue for all believers to understand and apply it. Hopefully, you have had a chance to listen to Dr. Neufeld's recent series on the subject called Skillful Living, focusing on Proverbs, known as wisdom literature. We learned all about what it means to live a wise and godly life. This great series is available on CD for our valuable listeners. To receive it, call us at 9492440070 or email at info@backtothebible.in.